Good morning, everyone. Today's daf in Ksuvos is daf Tzadi Aleph, 91. We're behind. We're back, all the way back now on Pei Testament base. We're starting at the Mishnah on the bottom of the Amud. Okay. The plan today is we'll, God willing, we'll finish the parak. We'll start the new parak, 10th parak of the Masechta. And hopefully the goal will be to get to the Mishnah on Tzadi Aleph, Amud Aleph. And then tomorrow, aided with a very short daf on Tzadi base, we'll be able to catch up to where we need to be. Daf Tzadi Gimel is a famous Mishnah. It's a difficult Mishnah. It's the famous bankruptcy Mishnah. If you don't know what I'm talking about, that's fine. When we get to it, you'll understand why it's so famous and somewhat complicated, but complex. But in the meantime, however, let's just wrap ourselves up. Thank the Lupin Foundation for sponsorship of the Daf. Daf is long as Zeich Nishmas, Libby Gabriela Bashmuel. And let's take a look at the Mishnah. Shnei Getzer v'shnei Ksuvos. So let's say the woman's coming. She's got two Getzer in her hand and she's got two Ksuvos in her hand. So and everything lines up. Rashi writes in the Mishnah, Zman Ksuva Rishona Kodem L'Zman Get Rishon, Zman Ksuva Shnia Kodem L'Get Sheni. So in terms of a timeline, the two documents are producing a perfect timeline. It was Ksuva Get, Ksuva Get. So go v'shnei Ksuva, so good. So now when she comes collect, she's entitled to two Ksuvas. Two Ksuvas were written for her. Presumably this is by the same husband. It doesn't really matter. It is written by the same husband. But okay, but when he married her a second time, he figured, you know what, this time it's really going to work, and maybe it did. Who knows? Could be that the second time it terminated in death and not in divorce. Either way, but because everything lined up, so she's able to collect her two ksuvas. However, shtei ksuvas v'get echad, but let's say there are two ksuvas and there's only one get. So the...
But if two gets, it couldn't have died.
I'm sorry. It didn't work out the second time as well. You're right. You're right. Okay. It worked as long as it worked. Or let's put it that way. Okay. Okay, good. All right, that's another way to say it. Yeah, okay. Excellent point. Okay. Shtei ksuvos v'get echad. Now let's talk about a scenario where there are two ksuvos and there's one get. And both of them are preceding the get. It only begs the question, what is she doing holding on to a second ksuva? So stay tuned, we're going to be discussing that in the Gemara. But anyway, shtei ksuvos get echad, o ksuva v'shnei gittin, or let's say there's one ksuva to couple with two gittin, so o ksuva v'get v'misa, or let's put three things together. She's got a ksuva, she also has got a bill of divorce, and her husband died. So ain't go v'el ksuva achas. So over here, so with one ksuva, you only collect once, period. So shamagar shesisha v'echzira, amenas ksuva v'shona machzira. So how in the world could she be holding two gets in her hand? Meaning, what was that all about? And again, everything's talking about one man and one woman. So she's holding two divorces. How's that working? So the Gemara says, very simply, because what happened was is that he married her first time, he wrote a ksuva. He divorced her. Okay. Mafsa grushaso. Okay, let's give it a second chance. So he marries her again. So does he have to write a new ksuva? So fundamentally, no. He doesn't have to write a new ksuva because he already was married to her. Obviously, we're talking about a case where he didn't satisfy the ksuva as of yet. If he did satisfy his ksuva, he can't recycle and reuse that old ksuva. That old ksuva has been paid up now. But if he didn't pay up the ksuva, so now after divorcing, he's like, you know, I've got this huge debt on my hands. I got this ksuva I got to pay. He goes back to her, knocks on the door, and says, you know what? I thought about it some more. Let's get married again. And you could just simply recycle and reuse the old ksuva. Good. So that's how, and unfortunately, Alex, I'm going to go back to your point. Unfortunately, it didn't work a second time. And so that's how it's possible a woman could have one ksuva and two gittin. Now, Ibai Bahai Gavi, Ibai Bahai Gavi. The Gemara's comment is going on the first case of the Mishnah. Shtei Ksuvos and one get. Okay, sorry, not the first case of the Mishnah. All right, Shtei Ksuvos and one get. Yeah, I'm with you. And now am I with you. Rashi's with you as well. Okay, so Shtei Ksuvos and one get. So the Mishnah says she can only collect but one time. Okay, now, which one? Seemingly from the Mishnah doesn't make this point clear, but seemingly she could use either one of them. So the Gemara says, now that's interesting, Lemei Taviti of the Rav Nachman HaMashmol. So the Gemara says, we're going to go back to a statement of Rav Nachman HaMashmol that we said earlier in the Masechta, and that is Amar Rav Nachman HaMashmol, Shei Shar, Ziyos, and Bezeh Achazeh, if I have two documents and they're basically speaking to the same loan, same borrower, same lender, same loan amount, and they're coming one after the other, Bito Shenes Rishon. So what must the second one do? The second one must uproot the first one. Now, what does that mean, uproot the first one? Uproot meaning that we know that with every loan document, there comes a Shiba, there comes a lien against the property. What does the lien go back to? It goes back to the date of the document. So if there was just one document, so we would go back to the date of the original document. The fact that now there is a second document, so that means that the second document must be an override in the first document, and so therefore your lien only goes back as far as the second document, not the first document. So the Gemara says, so what do you see? So you see that if I have two documents, two notes, same borrower, same lender, same amount, and I have a second one, and the second one overrides the first one, seemingly that would go against our Mishnah. So the Gemara says, not necessarily. Lavit marla marapapo moder of Nachman di emotive be digla la tosefis kasvei. So the Gemara says, look, as far as the two documents are concerned, if there's anything additional in the second document, so then we can argue that it's not an override of the first document. It's not a cancellation of the first document. It's there to be an amendment. It's an augmentation of the first document. So that we're going to say that the first document and its lien is still in force. And the only reason why the second document was written is just simply for the Davar Chiddush, only for the novel idea. So Hakadami Bida Osif Lay. So it could very well be that the same thing is true over here, meaning that maybe the second document was there to add on to the first document. Tana Rabban and the Gemara quotes there. Braisam. Hosea Geduksuva Mesa. So she is now producing a ksuva, because they were married, a get, because they went through a divorce, and also Ede Misa. And also witnesses that said that her husband died. So, her claim is, we were married twice. Married once, and then we got a divorce. Married a second time, and then he died. And so, in her claim, she would like now to collect two ksuvas. So, im get kon l'ksuva, go v'shte ksuvos. Ksuva kodemus l'ges, eno go v'el l'ksuva achas. Shem gar shesisha v'echzira, amanash ksuva rishon echzira. So, the Gemara points out, we're now on the top of Tzani Amud Aleph, so the Gemara points out very succinctly, good. So if the get comes before the ksuva, so then she's entitled to two ksuvas because the timeline works out that she in fact is that this ksuva is a representation of the second marriage. However, ksuva kedemas leget eino gova el ksuva achas. But if the ksuva predates the get, so then this get is a reflection of the first ksuva. So therefore, she only is going to be able to collect one ksuva. They were married a second time. Okay, but what he must have done is he must have recycled the first ksuva for that second round of marriage. Okay, Mishnah. Kan she'isia aviv. Okay, let's say a katan gets married. Now, what confused me so much about this Mishnah, and then all I do is make one little shift in my mind, and then the Mishnah perfectly worked out, is I was thinking we're talking about a minor girl, because generally speaking, when we're talking about a katana, so we're talking about a minor girl who's married off by her father, that's the marriage minat Torah, right? We explore that case time and again throughout the Masechta, throughout the previous Masechta in Yevamos, and then it occurred to me that, of course, that's not what the Mishnah is talking about. It's talking about a boy getting married, right? A katan. And now I totally, and the, once I made that little discovery, so then all of a sudden the Mishnah just totally clarified. And the Mishnah over here is talking about now where a katan is getting married. Now, let's go over some basics. A katan can't get married, and even if there's a father, and even if the father is providing das, it doesn't work that way. The only thing that a father can do is marry off his daughter, because the Torah puts the daughter under the jurisdiction of the father, and so therefore the father can provide das for the daughter. But the father doesn't have that ability with his son, so what the Mishnah now is describing is a marriage that isn't a marriage. It's that simple. So kanchi siwaviv, so ksuvasa kayemis. Shamanas Kain Kaima. So now, as they're married, again, when I say married, originally, we're going to put that in quotes, because they're not married. They're living together. I don't know what this is. The Mishnah is not condoning it. I'm not, like, in other words, it's just unclear to me, or maybe the Mishnah is, it is unclear to me what the structure of that thing is prior to him growing up and becoming an adult. Okay, but the point the Mishnah is going to make is a very simple point. Even though at the time when they're married, they're not married. As long as it continues and perpetuates, and they're going to grow together, and they're going to become adults together, so even though there was a ksuva that was written at a time when the marriage was not a marriage, at when the ksuva can be effective, it will kick in. So, kan shi siu aviv ksuva, so kayem shamanas ken kaimam. Okay, good. A second case, which is basically speak to the same idea. Gershon is Gai Yishto Yimo. Let's say a non-Jewish couple both convert. Okay, and they're married as non-Jews. And they wrote a ksuva. Now, again, a ksuva is a prenuptial agreement. So it's not, in other words, it's totally within the realm of possibility that as non-Jews, he wrote her a ksuva, a prenuptial agreement. So after they convert, can they bank on this ksuva that they wrote as non-Jews? The Mishnah says, yeah, sure. Gershis Gai Rishayim Ok Suvasa Kayemis, Shamanas King Kayma. Good. So two scenarios in which the marriage is not a bona fide marriage, either because he's a minor and he doesn't have das, or because they're not Jewish. Either way, when they get, and the ksuva was written at that stage, and when they get to the point of the marriage being a sanctioned marriage, so the ksuva can kick in, and there's no need to write a new ksuva. Presumably. I mean, in terms of the details, you could be right. The Mishnah is just illustrating a scenario in which, even though from its inception the ksuva is not obligated, but it can kick in at a later point in time. You could kickstart the ksuva later in their lives.
If the couple dies, who would she collect from?
No, it's not a marriage. It's not a ksuva, it's not a marriage. It only will be a marriage, only when he becomes an adult. Mm-hmm. The only point the Mishnah is making is that the ksuva could kick in later on, even though it was written earlier. Mm-hmm. Okay, now when we say the ksuva kicks in, what part of the ksuva? So again, as we know the ksuva is really constructed of a base amount, and then any additional amount that is deemed that the husband wants to. So when we say that the ksuva kicks in, are we talking about mana masayim, or are we talking about also the tosefis? Now, again, mana masayim, the base amount. Remember, this is one of the big themes of the ninth parak as we finish up the ninth parak. The idea that a ksuva is a virtual ksuva, meaning that existent within every marriage, constructed, woven into every marriage, is the idea that the chachamim, it's a maisa based in, the chachamim instituted into every marriage a ksuva. So you don't even need to write the document. There's no need for a piece of paper. Good. These are ideas that we've been exploring for over the duration of the ninth parak. So it's very easy to argue that when the ksuva was written and it had no force and it will kick in later, maybe the only thing that kicks in is only the base amount, because that is the institution of marriage in ksuva. But the tosefis, well, the tosefis ain't law. So according to Rav Huna, not the tosefis. In order for the tosefis to work, so to say, in order for the husband to be obligated to tosefis, it has to be at the time of writing, the husband has to be in a state of mind where I'm writing a ksuva document. Otherwise, it doesn't kick in later on. So that's Rav Huna's opinion. Rav Yehuda, Amar Afilo Tosefes Yesh La. And Rav Yehuda disagrees. He says, no, when the ksuva kicks in, the entirety of the ksuva kicks in, including the Tosefes. Meis for the Gemara challenges based on a brisa. It's a short brisa. Chidshu, no, tell us Mashe Chidshu. If they were Mechadesh, meaning, as the katan becomes an adult, after the katan becomes an adult, after the convert converts, if you add on to the ksuva, to the original ksuva, you then have the ability to add on. And the diuk over here is very simple, and the Gemara makes the diuk. Chidshu in, lo chidshu lo. So that means that if something was added on, great. But if nothing was added on, so then we only go back to the base amount. So ema af mashe chidshu. So the Gemara says, well, maybe we can make the following argument. Maybe we could say that when the ksuva kicks in, the entirety of the ksuva kicks in, both the base amount and the additional amount, and the brice is speaking to, and I'd like to add more on top of that. The Gemara says, V'alo tenihachi. Yeah, but the brice doesn't say that. The brice reads, chidshu, no tell us mashe chidshu, lo chidshu. This is the brice talking now, so we're no longer in the world of diukim. The brice says, lo chidshu, besula gova masayim v'almanamana. The brice says, says very clearly that without a chiddush, so then what of the ksuva kicks in? Only the base amount of the ksuva kicks in.
And chiddush, it would be pushed. Why not?
Okay, so maybe you could have argued. I'm still going to throw out a svara. Maybe you can argue that you can't add an addendum to a document that was already written. Maybe I don't. Okay. Your point very well taken. We did this. So Tiyufta de Rabbi Yehuda. So the Gemara says, okay, now that you know the Braisa, now the Braisa says very clearly that when a ksuva kickstarts later on in their lives, only the base amount kicks in, and the Braisa says exactly like Rav Huna. And then the Gemara just wonders, how did Rav Yehuda arrive at his conclusion? It's a conclusion that is not accepted halachically. The Braisa clearly refutes it. But what got him to that point? So the Gemara says, Rav Yehuda Masisa Natase. So the Gemara says, look, in defense of Rav Yehuda, meaning even though he's already been rejected, but in defense of his position, look back at the Mishnah. What did the Mishnah teach us? Hu sevar ksuvasa kayemis. Because the language of the Mishnah certainly speaks to the idea where the Mishnah says, the ksuva, meaning the Mishnah is talking about the totality of the ksuva. The ksuva is still intact. So, akula mil sakai. So he thought the ksuva, when the Mishnah was describing, was the entirety of the ksuva velohi, a ikar ksuva kai. No. And what you're going to have to understand is that when the Mishnah says that the ksuva is kayam, it means the base amount of the ksuva is kayam. That's how, that's a proper way to understand the Mishnah. That's obviously Rav Huna's way of understanding the Mishnah. Hajalach hakosev liishto. And adkan, that ends the ninth parak of the Masechta. Okay, we begin now the 10th parak of the Masechta. Mishaya Nasri Shtei Nashim. Okay, a man is married to two women, Umeis, and the man dies. Harishona Kodemus L'Shnia. So now, obviously, each one of them is holding a note against the estate. The first wife and the second wife. And let's talk about a scenario where he did not marry them at the same time, which, by the way, parenthetically, should not marry them at the same time. Ain Marvin Simcha B'Simcha, right? You can't mix Simchas together. In fact, if that sounds familiar, it should, because that's what Lavan told Yaakov, meaning, okay, I understand now you want to marry Rachel, but let's wait a week. Okay, a common misconception, right? That he waited a year before he married, he waited 7 years before he married Rachel. That's not accurate. He waited a week before he married Rachel, and then he worked another 7 years. So he didn't marry both at the same time. So one wife was into the marriage first. So that means that she's an earlier lien holder against the estate. So then we're going to just work with the basic rules of holding liens. Whoever's got an earlier date is the first one who's able to extract. So Arishona Kedemus L'Shnia. So therefore, the first wife obviously has the rights to collect before the second wife. V'yorshe Arishona Kedemus L'Yorshe Shnia. And in terms of the inheritance, meaning if that either of these women die subsequently, and that note gets passed on to the next generation, so still, that doesn't change the lien of the note, so that the Yorshim of each one of them also have a specific order. The Yorshim of the first wife are entitled to the estate more than the Yorshim of the second wife. Good. Very good, very straightforward. Next part of the Mishnah. Nasa Rishona Umesa, Nasa Shnia Umesu. Now we're going to talk about a scenario where he marries two women, but the order of death goes like this. He marries the first woman and she dies. Then he marries the second wife and then he dies. Okay, so now, at this point in time, we have the following scenario coming about. In other words, we have the first wife. What happens to her, all of her assets, when she dies, the first wife? It all goes to the husband. A husband is Yoresh's wife, Minatorah. Okay, some say Midrabanan, but either way, the husband inherits his wife's assets. Good. So when she died, all the estate goes to the husband. Then what happened was he married his second wife, and then he died. Now, that second wife is a creditor. She now is entitled, or she's entitled to the receivable of her ksuva. So now what happens? So umesu shnia v'yorsheha kodmin liyorshe rishona. The second wife and anyone who inherits that note of the second wife, meaning the ksuva, is going to precede the yorshe rishona, those who inherit her from the first wife. What is going on over here? So what's going on over here is the following. We know we have an institution, a rabbinic institution that goes all the way back to Daf Nun Beis in our Masechta, and that's what's called Ksuvas Benin Dichrin. Do you remember? Let's remind ourselves. We know that when a husband dies and he leaves wives and he leaves children, so the children inherit. The wives have a note outstanding against the estate, but the children inherit. What do they inherit? All the assets of the father. simple period, the halach of Yerusha. That we all know. However, the Chachamim we're worried about is the following. My daughter's going to get married. My daughter's going to marry that guy. And I'm going to throw a lot of money into that marriage. I'm going to give them I'm going to give them venture capital, if you will, into that marriage. And what I'm going to do is it'll be a dowry. It'll be a significant dowry, a good portion of my estate, like we learned earlier in the Masechta. Right, the suggested amount is 10% of his estate is going to be given over to his daughter, and subsequently now it'd be thrown into that marriage. But let's think about this now from the perspective of the father-in-law. Father-in-law is going to throw all that money into the marriage, and then what? And then my son-in-law is going to marry a second wife, and a third wife, and a fourth wife, and then what's going to happen is that he's going to die, and then what's going to happen? And my grandchildren, together with a collection of other grandchildren, are going to go ahead and inherit my estate. No, thank you. Meaning, if I know that there's going to be a legacy and my estate's going to be passed down to my grandchildren, that I can tolerate. But the idea that I amassed all this money and it's going to go to other children, right? Just because he decided that he's going to marry other women, which, by the way, going back to Lavan, once again, Lavan, one of the conditions that Lavan says to Yaakov is, and oh, by the way, you can't marry more women. I'm not saying that's the reason why, but just reminded me. So anyway, so no thank you. So the Chachamim understood that this was a consideration, this was a concern. So therefore, the Chachamim instituted the Takana of Ksuvas Ben Indichrin. And the way Ksuvas Ben Indichrin works is as follows. That when the man dies, when I'm going out to the son-in-law, so when he dies, first things first, before a division of his estate, the first thing that's going to happen is that all the assets that he inherited from his wives are then going to first be distributed to their respective children, meaning the children of this wife is going to be receiving the dowry that the father inherited from the mother. The children of that wife are going to be inheriting the dowry that mom received from her father, from their grandfather. And then, and only after that, the remainder of the estate is going to be divided equitably amongst the children. And this is what's called Ksuvas Ben Indichrin. This was a rabbinic institution. This is actually written into the Ksuva. Okay? So far, so good?
Isn't the son of the first wife gets a double portion?
The firstborn?
Yes.
Okay, good. Yeah, firstborn gets double portion. That's correct. But we're in other words, this is a separate issue. This is Ksuvas Ben Indichrin. Okay. Now, with that in mind, so now let's consider our scenario. Our scenario is where a man was married to a woman, she died, so he inherited all of her assets. Now he married a second woman, and then he died. Okay. Now, Ksuvas Ben Indichrin in this scenario only applies to one set of children, only to his first wife's children. Ksuvas Ben Indichrin doesn't apply to the second wife's children because she's still alive. Ksuvas Ben Indichrin is only going to apply when she predeceases him and all of her estates go to the husband. Then, as it drops down, first things first, the dowries are divided, then the rest of the estate are divided. Here, in this scenario, only the first wife predeceases the husband. So now, let's think about this. This is where it's going to get tricky. But if you think about it, it really makes sense. What's going to now happen is as follows. So, you have the death of the first wife, then the death of the husband, and now what happens to his estate? So first and foremost, the estate gets inherited by the inheritors. But then what happens? Then you have the creditors coming, and the creditors saying to the estate, okay, mazel tov on your inheritance, but there's outstanding debts. So we're therefore entitled to collect on the debts. So again, now listen to the Mishnah. So nasa sarishona umesa, nasa shnia umeshu, shnia v'yorsheha, kodmim liyorshe rishona. The wife, the second wife, and anyone who stands to inherit her note, is going to precede the first wife. At first it doesn't make sense, now it makes perfect sense. Because what happens is that his estate and the portion of his estate that he inherited from his first wife goes down to his children, but they inherit it. But then what happens is that the second wife is standing there as a creditor, and therefore she is allowed to come and now collect her debt. It's not a debt, but it's an obligation. The obligation of Ksuva. The outstanding obligation of Ksuva. So now she's, and if there is a limited resource, meaning, let's say there's only enough money to satisfy only one of those two ksuvas, oddly enough, the second one is going to get it over that the first one. And if you think about it, it's a little bit strange. Meaning the rabbinic institution that was there to protect is now going to be serving as a means, as a vehicle, to allow the second wife to collect her ksuva over that of the first wife. Now, I know that's strange, but as we just went through the mechanics, it really makes perfect sense. The first ones are the inheritors. The children of the first wife are inheritors. And the second one is a creditor. Okay? Midiktani, we go to the Gemara. We're on Sani Amad Aleph. We finished the first Mishnah. Two halachas that are mentioned in the first Mishnah. We're going to the first halacha. You know, first things first. That's the way the Gemara always works. In the first case of the Mishnah, a man was married to two women, and the man died. So each one of the wives now stands as a creditor, as they each have a receivable to collect against the estate. So obviously the first wife, the first widow, I should say, is obviously entitled to her ksuva first. Now midiktani rishana kodemus lishniya. So the Gemara makes a fascinating diuk in the Mishnah. In the Mishnah, what do we say? That there's a line, and one gets before two. Now, anyone who went to I do not recommend this. It's a chil Hashem. But you ever go to an amusement park and you cut the line? So as and right, correct. Depending on right, you're going back to Coney Island, so you know it's more dangerous. But and you know if no one sees you, which is unlikely, or if you're intimidating looking, so everyone's going to be upset with you. But you know, okay, good. You jump the line. So you know the Mishnah says that the first one's in front of the second one. But what if the second one makes a move? And in this case, the second widow. And she goes and she takes the estate with her ksuva. But she's second in line. It sounds like from the Mishnah, it's not right, but it works. Because the Mishnah doesn't say ein la, the Mishnah says that the first one is kodemus lishnia, meaning she should go first. But the second one goes first, right. What's done is done. So mechlal di ikad mishniya v'tafso lo mafkina mina. So shma mina ba mechav me'ucha shekadim v'gava ma shegav v'gava. So if that's true, we arrive at a very interesting conclusion. And that is, again, both widows are balechov. They both hold a note against the estate. And one has an earlier date than the other. Now again, right thing is, obviously the one with the earlier date should go in first. But if the second balechov comes in and seizes, so then what's done is done. Masha asa asui. Or in this case, masha gava gava. That's a very interesting halacha that's really difficult to understand. And why do I say that? Well, first of all, I don't have to say that. Tosus says it. But tema. You want to see the second Tosus in our perek? Tema masvarehizu. Meaning, this is so illogical. That you have now a second in line as a note holder, and if he grabs, or in this case, if she grabs, what's done is done. Tosa says, "Delo yeh balchov ela kolokeach demelokeach gufe ketarif balchov rishon." You think about it; this is perfectly illogical. This really smacks in the face of what is sound and reasonable. Because let's think about this for a moment. When I'm a lien holder on a property, that gives me such a strong right to that property. Meaning, what do we know? We know that if the property sold off to somebody else, that means somebody else paid good money for that property, I can go over to that buyer and I can say to him, look, I'm really sorry. I'm a lien holder. I'm entitled. I take it. You'll get reimbursed from him. Maybe yes, maybe no. It's not my business. My business is that I was a creditor. I have a note. I'm a lien holder. I'm taking it away from you. So now Tosus asks really a fantastic question. So if the Baal Chov can take it away from a lokeach, so over here, you don't think that the first Baal Chov should be able to take it away from the second Baal Chov? Second Baal Chov should be any better than a lokeach?
Right.
Good. That's a powerful question. So
But the thing is that the lokeh has a due diligence issue that the balcony
good, doesn't. Good, 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 good. Okay, excellent. So Tosfos over here offers two suggestions. V'tiritz Rashbam. So Tosfos says, number one, we'll suggest the following. Debalchov mukhar diyif malokeach shlotin odelos b'fnei lovim. Okay, so a suggestion number one of Tosfos is, yeah. You know, very often we do things, we find things in throughout Shas, that basically the Chachamim want to promote lending. Okay, so promotion of lending is it creates a healthy economy. Okay, and I don't want to speak like an economist and sound like an economist, but the only thing I can tell you is the Chachamim were bent on this idea that there needs to be lending going on. Lending is critical. So the so Tosos' first answer, he quotes the Rashbam, one of the Balei Tosos, and he says, you know what, yeah, when you're buying a piece of property, okay, so yeah, we understand a lien holder has the right to say it. But over here, both the first and second lien holders are lenders. And even though a first lien holder can take away land from a property, from a buyer, but not necessarily from a second lien holder. Because essentially then what's that going to do is, that's going to really deter people from lending. Because I'm going to lend, and what's going to happen, I'm not going to be able to be paid back. Meaning I should be able to be paid back. So therefore, we're going to inject more power into the second lien holder than we would to a casual buyer of the property. Okay, just so that we promote lending in general. That's one suggestion of Tosfos. A second suggestion of Tosfos, Ben, you did a good job in terms of the owed T rates. Okay, skipping. I'm just giving you the highlights of Tosfos. Fourth wide line down. Otir it's the hasam b'matalton lefichach mashigava gava, ava b'mekarke mashigava lo gava. So the Gemara says maybe over here in terms of the second creditor coming and taking, maybe that's in reference to movable assets. So movable assets. So then it'll be a whoever gets there first is going to be able to get it. There's a meaning in theory there should be an order. And more than theory, meaning there's really an order. But and when it comes to movable assets, whoever can get there first will be able to take and to take whatever theirs. But in terms of land has a order, and the first lien holder has a right to collect it over the second lien holder, even according to this opinion of a Balchov Meuchar can come and take. That's only speaking to movables, not to land. Okay, back to the Gemara.
No.
This is assuming that there's not enough money for both of them.
Right.
Right. That's why it's such a big chiddush that a second lien holder can come and take before the first. Right. Again, the Gemara is going to argue the other direction as well. All we're trying to do is just think through how can the Gemara even maintain such a position that the second lien holder is going to be able to seize and hold on to that which he seized, especially when a buyer can't do that. Okay. Next. Back to the Gemara. So la'olam emelcha mashigava lo gava. The Gemara says, look, from our Mishnah, let's not conclude that way. But rather, what we're going to say is as follows. My kodemus legamre, and when it says kodemus, it means legamre. Kodemus means, we're not just putting them in a particular order, it means this is a fixed order, where one comes in front of two, and one is in front of two to the exclusion of two. Okay, which kedetan ben kodel amas. In other words, I'll give you a simple example: a Mishnah Baba Basra, and the Mishnah Baba Basra says that when a father dies and leaves a son and a daughter, the son comes before the daughter. Now, before over there does not mean that if the daughter goes and inherits that which she inherited is hers, because over there that's simply not true. The son is inheriting to the exclusion of the daughter, even though the Mishnah uses the word kodemus. Good. Ikedamre. We're going to do this again. Another version of the discussion. Midalokteni im kad mashnia v'tafsa in motzim yadam. Michlal di kad mashnia v'tafsa mafkina mine. The Gemara is going to start off this second version of the discussion with the opposite diuk. Is that if the second one takes, notice how the Mishnah didn't say if the second one takes, that which he takes is his. So that implies that the fact that the Mishnah didn't say that is that the second one has absolutely no right to take. And if he does, mafkina minay, we take it away from him. So you see over here that the second in line has no ability to take, even b'di'evit. And again, the Gemara is just going to be argumentative, meaning the Mishnah cannot be conclusive proof. I did the Tana Shnia v'Yarsha, according to Yarsha Rishona. So Tana Nami Rishona Kodemus L'Shnia. Look, since the Mishnah was using a certain formulation in the second half of the Mishnah, so the first half of the Mishnah uses a similar formulation just as a means of complementing. Remember, Mishnahs were meant to be committed to memory, and so therefore there is a certain sing-song pattern to the Mishnah, and so that's why the Mishnah uses a certain formulation, but the Deek isn't necessarily so. Okay, Nasas Rishona. Now we move on to the second case of the Mishnah, and we're in the second half of the of Tanya Amud Beis, and here things are going to get like just a little bit tricky. Again, let's reset the scenario. Let's make sure that we got this well. We have a man who married two wives, but in succession. So in other words, he married one woman, she died, he then married a second woman, and then the husband died. And now we're looking at his estate. So his estate, according to, it says the Mishnah, is inherited by his children and that of the and the ksuva of his wife also is going down to the children as well. And so therefore the ksuva of the second wife becomes collectible first. Because the ksuva of the first wife went into the estate already, because she died. So went into the estate, went down to the children. They inherited the ksuva, and therefore the ksuva of the second wife becomes a first in line for collection. That is what we learned together in the Mishnah. Shema minatlas. So the Gemara says, in summation, there are 3 points that we can conclude from our Mishnah. Number one, Shema mina achas b'chayev achas b'mosi yeshtem ksuvas minin dechren. V'lo chayshin alin suye. Okay. Point number one. I might have thought, that the institution of ksuvas minin dechren is limited only to the following scenario. Man's married to two women. He dies. Sorry. Let's start again. Man's married to two women. The both of them die. He inherits the dowry of both, the ksuva of both, and then the man dies. Under those circumstances, the rabbis institute a ksuva's benin dechren, meaning before we touch anything in the estate, so first things first, your mother's ksuva is going to be inherited by you, your mother's ksuva is going to be inherited by you, and then after that, we're going to divide the rest of the estate. I might have thought in that scenario, in that quote-unquote perfect scenario, I mean, it's not perfect, but in the idea that both sets of children are going to be inheriting their mother's ksuva, so then fine. Because if you think about it, what is ksuva's been indifferent going to affect? The idea that we're not going to get an equitable distribution. Because before we touch the estate, first I'm getting my mom's dowry, and the other one's saying, and I'm going to get my mom's dowry, and it may not be equal. However, think about what's happening over here. What's happening over here is that the man was married to two women, but one of them predeceased him, and the second one survived him. And so now when he dies, so now are we going to institute ksuvas benin dechren? You can make an argument. It's not wise over here to institute ksuvas benin dechren. Because that what that means now is that of all of his children that he has, some are going to be receiving their mother's dowry, and some, of course, are not. And so that would lead to fighting, significant fighting amongst the children. And therefore, one could have made the argument that in such a scenario, the rabbis did not institute ksuvas benin dechren. The fact that our Mishnah says that the second wife and the children of the second wife stand as creditors against the estate and against the ksuva of the first wife, so that means that the children are inheriting the ksuva of the first wife. So what the Mishnah is telling us is that even though ksuva's been indifferent is only going to be affected for one set of children, still there's an enactment of ksuva's been indifferent even in that case as well. Okay, that's point number one. So, achz b'chayv, achz b'mos, yesham ksuvas benin dechren. Lo cheshin l'nsuyeh. Mimai, and the Gemara just simply goes over. Midiktani shnei v'yoshe akodim l'yoshe v'shona, miktim hu dekadmi. Ha'ika shaklei. But that means that if there's enough for everybody, everybody's going to take. Meaning the sons are going to take their mother's dowry. The second wife is going to take her, is going to collect her ksuva. Fine. Shma mina. Point number two to take into consideration, that's as follows. Now let's, before we go to point number two, let's review something we learned together. Ksuva's been indichrin. Is basically that before we divide the estate, everyone's going to get their mother's ksuva. Okay. And does that mean that if, let's say, just for argument's sake, each ksuva is worth $200. I'm just throwing out numbers so that we understand, so that you can see it. Each ksuva is worth $200. And dad died and he left $400. So do you mean to tell me that each set of children are going to be getting first their mother's ksuva, leaving $0 as actual Yerusha? The rabbinic institution of ksuva has been in Dichrin is going to just totally override the halacha of Yerusha. The halacha of Yerusha is a din d'oraisa. And the ksuvas ben dichrin is a rabbinic institution. And they're going to do that? So if you remember what we learned earlier is, the only time that we're going to institute ksuvas ben dichrin is only after the dowries are divided amongst the children, there's going to be left over for the halacha of Yerusha min haTorah. How much left over? So if you remember we learned this earlier, one dinar. One dinar's worth of property has to be left over after ksuva's been in dichrin. And if there is not a surplus, and there is only enough in the estate to just cover ksuva's been in dichrin, so then we do not institute ksuva's been in dichrin. Ksuva's been in dichrin gets voided, and then it's just a regular Yerusha. This is what we learned earlier together. Now, let's go over the following. This is going to be point number two. Dad dies. Now again, what happened in this scenario? He had one wife already he was married to who predeceased him. And he inherited her ksuva. And now that ksuva is going to the children. Okay. And specifically her children. And then also he left a widow. In other words, he had a second wife who survived him. Now what do we say? The second wife is able to collect her ksuva. Okay. Let's imagine that by the second wife collecting her ksuva, there will be nothing left in the estate. Meaning her ksuva is going to be equivalent to the entire estate. Can we make the argument in that case that we're not going to institute ksuvas ben dichrin? Because in doing so, you're basically going to have no Yerusha. What this really touches on is a more basic question. And that's as follows. When you inherit, and you inherit a lot of money, but there's also a lot of outstanding bills against the estate, or a lot of receivables against the estate, so is that still considered inheritance? Do we call that a Yerusha? Yes or no? So the Gemara says, this is what the second point is coming out over here. Shema mina ksuva nasis moser lechaverta, that the ksuva is considered surplus against its chaverta, against its literally its friend. What that means is that even though after inheritance, there's that second wife with a ksuva, and she's a creditor, she's a balchov, and she's going to be collecting, even if we're going to argue, she collects the entirety of it, that's still considered an inheritance. The first children are considered as if they inherited, even though it's all going to end up going to the creditor. So, mimai midolok tani miyesha moser dinar. And the Gemara says, because look, the Mishnah didn't make any stipulation. The Mishnah says, you know, in this case, we're going to legislate Moshe Ksuva's ben dichrin, but only if after they satisfy the Ksuva, the second wife, there's going to be a surplus left over, so that which they inherit. The Mishnah doesn't say that. It makes it sound like even if that Ksuva of that second wife is going to totally deplete them out of their inheritance, we're still going to institute Ksuva's ben dichrin. In other words, even after you inherit, and then you have all the creditors coming in, and like vultures coming in and taking from you, and even if they took everything, that's still considered Yerusha. And finally, Ksuva's ben dichrin, lo tarfe mimishabde. And also, another thing, a third point, which at this point, this third point is obvious. And that is, ksuvas ben dichrin do not collect from creditors. Meaning, when you receive ksuvas ben dichrin, that's Yerusha. That's not a receivable, that's Yerusha. Why? Because think about what's going to happen. The Gemara points that Adisa Agadat and Tarfa Mimishabde, because if your ksufa has been in different entitlement, allows you, treats you as creditors, so Leisa B'nei Rishona V'Letzifrin L'B'nei Shnia. Because what's going to happen? The second are going to be taken from the first. The first are going to say, you know, it's funny. We're coming in with the strength of our mother's ksuva. Our mother's ksuva predated your mother's ksuva. Or they could be talking to the widow herself. Our mother's ksuva predates your ksuva. So that's funny, you're taking from us. We're going to take right back from you. But why don't they do that? Because when they're inheriting their mother's ksuva, they're not doing so as a note collector, but they're taking it as a Yerusha. Okay, good. Those are the 3 points. Maskav la Rav Ashi mimai. So Rav Ashi challenges some of these points. Gemara says maybe not. Maybe that if the man was married to two wives, but survived by one of them, maybe we will not institute ksuvas ben indichrin. Or my kodmim, lanachla katani. So, and when we say kodmim, we just simply mean lanachla. V'chitem yorshe rishon lamali. So then why are we describing the inheritors of the first one? I did the tanishniya v'yorshe taninam liyorshe rishona. Again, for the purpose of symmetry. Udikamak ksuva nasis mosel chaverta. And as far as the second conclusion is concerned, which is that when you inherit, and then the creditors come and take everything that's still considered inheritance. Again, that conclusion is not absolutely conclusive. As far as our mission is concerned, maybe there was a surplus after. In other words, the mission didn't mention it, but maybe there was. I'm sorry, period. So the Gemara just simply deflects. Look, conclusion one, maybe so, but it's not conclusive. Conclusion two, maybe so, but once again, it's not conclusive. Now, and this issue of, did the rabbis institute ksuvas ben indichrin, if both wives didn't die before he did, and one of the wives survived him, Gemara says, that could be a machlokus between Tanaim, the Tanya. Gemara quotes the Braisa. Meso achas b'chai v'achas b'moso. So here's the case. A man was married to two wives. One predeceased him. One survived him. So what's the halacha? Benana so amir yichol menei rishon olam ala b'nei shniya. So the sons of the first wife will say to that of the second wife, B'nei ba'alas chovatem, t'lu ksuvasim chem, utzu'u. Take the ksuva of your mother and leave. That's the opinion of Ben Nanas. Rabbi Kiva Omer, kvar kavtza nachla, m'lefnei b'nei rishona, v'nafla v'nei b'nei shniya. So the nachla jumped from the estate of the first to the estate of the second. Now, that's very obscure. It's ambiguous. What's going on over here? My love, Akamiflagi. So the Gemara suggests now this is a Pshan the Machlokas. That maybe the institution of Ksuvas Ben Indichrin is applied even if one of the wives survives him. And that would be the opinion of Benanas. And that's why the second wife and her children can say, look, we're going to come in, we're going to take your Yerusha because we're creditors. And then Rabbi Kiva would say, no, that the institution of Ksuvas Ben Indichrin is not employed. And in the yeshiva, they said, look, we're going to deflect. No, we think that the rabbis institute ksuvas ben indichrin, even if only one of the wives predeceased him. And over here, the issue is that when you inherit, but then the creditors come and take everything, is that called inheritance? And the issue over here between Rabbi Kiva and Menanas is that when you have creditors coming and taking everything, are you still considered that you inherited the estate? The Amina Luhana. Now, after they told me that, I told them my opinion, and that is, look, if you have regular creditors coming and basically plucking away all your assets that you and all your brothers inherited, that's called an inheritance. And it's called life. Meaning, after you inherit, so not only did dad give you all that wonderful estate, but he also gave to you as well a lot of outstanding accounts payable. He gave you a lot of debt as well. So, okay, that's called the Yerusha. Ki pligi b'ksuva. But over here, by ksuva, I don't know. meaning it's not external creditors coming and coming at you. Aksuva is, excuse me, aksuva is more internal. Aksuva is, right, it's the wife and it's the children of the wife, but they're also your brothers. So I don't know if they come and collect all the Yerusha that you Yarshan, I don't know if that would be considered like you Yarshaned and it's just creditors came and take from you because they're not external creditors, they're internally based. So the Gemara says, yeah, look, all this is well and good, but then I don't understand the language of Rabbi Akiva. What did he say? Kvar kafta nachla. In other words, the inheritance occurred. What really Rabbi Akiva should be saying is, look, not always, if there's a surplus. And so Rav Yosef says, we're going to go back to our first suggestion, and that is that the debate occurring in the Mishnah, I'm sorry, the debate occurring in the Braisa, is whether or not Ksuvas ben Indichrin is going to be affected if one wife predeceases the husband, but one wife survived. And so now, are we going to institute Ksuvas ben Indichrin in such a scenario? Let's quickly recap, and let's pause. We finished the previous Masechta, the previous Perek, a discussion of a woman showing up with two ksuvas. How do we treat those two ksuvas? So if the timeline is good, so then she'll collect both. But if the timeline is no good, so then she'll only collect one. We talked about holding multiple notes against one obligation. Is the second note a cancellation of the first note? That's where we ended off the ninth parak. The tenth parak started off with a discussion of a man being married to two women. So in terms of the ksuva, so we basically look at the lien holders and we put them in line. What if each woman obviously has a date on her ksuva, the earlier date is the first one that's entitled. What if a second lien holder comes and jumps in front of the first lien holder? So the Gemara made an argument that the second lien holder is able to seize even after the first one, although that was debatable. And what we tried to do is to try to give an argument in terms of why you can even maintain such a position. We saw Tosfos. And finally, the end of the discussion we had today was whether or not the rabbinic institution of Ksuvas ben Indichrin is going to be implemented in a scenario where one of the wives survived the husband, and so now you have one set of children inheriting Ksuvas ben Indichrin, another set not inheriting Ksuvas ben Indichrin, and maybe the rabbis did not institute the institution over there because it would lead to such fighting amongst the brothers, and that is also open for a debate, and tomorrow we're going to conclude.